Why don't we go? Sure. We're called to order. I don't know if we may have some members on the phone today. Senator Senjum and Representative Lachesky. If you're there, you can speak up when you wish. Okay. So, can we first approve the minutes from last meeting, the 30th?
Which should make a motion to approve the minutes.
All right, Representative Murphy moves the minutes. Any discussion on that? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Those are approved. So, Mr. Baumtrog.
Mr. Speaker.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, sorry. Oh,
I was just going to make a comment, if I might. I'd just like you to note that the House Republicans are here 100% today, so maybe that can be a good example for the Senate Republicans in the future.
Okay. Noted in the minutes. Was ever doing that. Okay. Well, go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Ryan Baumtrog. I work for Minnesota Management and Budget, and I've been asked to testify today about the price of government report that we produce. So I'll be giving a little background on the price of government and then also giving a status update given the 2013 legislative session. So a little background on the price of government. It's a report that Minnesota Management and Budget produces at every forecast, as well as with proposed governor's budgets and the enacted budget. It's a measure of the relative cost of state and local government. And what it's really meant to do is provide a pretty plain speak, easy to understand metric of the value or what citizens are paying for the services they get at the state and also local governments. And it reflects state and local income, state and local tax, and also non-tax revenues compared to Minnesota's personal income. So again, it's really a state and local finance transparency tool comparing how revenues are raised against Minnesota's total income. So I want to break down, before we get into the results or the status, just wanted to break down a few of the components just to help with the understanding of what it's measuring. So price of government provides own source revenues. So it looks at revenues that are directly collected by state and local units of government. So that includes cities, townships, counties, as well as schools. And provides by those different units, looks at taxes and also the various non-tax revenues that all of those different jurisdictions collect. It also provides information about intergovernmental revenues, so state aids that the localities receive from the state, other local aids, and federal grants. So it really provides a finance transparency tool of all the different revenues that comprise the different levels of services that the state and locals provide. What the price of government doesn't include is enterprise revenues, such as local utilities or liquor stores, or revenues that are raised for a specific purpose. Those are excluded. But otherwise, the price of government is meant to be very inclusive to look at all of the revenues that the state and locals raise. So again, the revenues raised are divided against Minnesota's personal income. And the personal income is really the broadest real-time measure of Minnesota's economic activity. And so that's why back when this started in the early 90s, that's why it was chosen, because it was really the largest swath and the most encompassing of the economic activity in the state. And so it provides the dollar value of all of Minnesotans' receipts. So it's your wage and salary disbursements, your proprietor's income, interest and dividends, transfer payments. It's a very large swath of personal receipts. The series comes from the U.S. Department of Commerce, but the projections are what we do to update with both the forecasts in November and February. Minnesota Management and Budget economists actually provide the updates to it using the state and national models. So they really, every forecast, we always change the personal income forecast. And so the price of government changes at those points in time. So besides boiling it all down, besides providing a metric that people can look at to understand, you know, how much of their personal income is provided for the services they receive at the local government and state level, the price of government also highlights the differences in who raises and who spends the revenues. And so it's interesting to look at how certain policies or how money is raised at different levels and then who actually spends it. So by looking at the price of government, you can see that the state collects, you know, nearly two-thirds of the total revenue across all jurisdictions of government, but that the state only spends 36% of it. And so the difference there is that a lot of the revenue that the state raises ends up going to school districts and cities and counties in the form of aid. And so the price of government allows you to see where the revenue is being raised, how impacts succession, how they flow, and then actually who spends the money. So when you look at school districts, for example, they only raise 8% of the total revenues in the state, but yet they're spending over 27%, and that's largely because of all the state aid that that we provide. Now, again, this started many years ago, back in 1991 or 1990. It started when our series first started. And so we're able to look at the price of government over time. The blue bars up on top, if you have a color copy, I hope you do, or the light shaded ones, are the projections for fiscal 13 all the way through fiscal 17. Fiscal year 12 is the last actual that we have. But we're able to see over time how the relationship between the revenues that the state raises and how that relates to the personal income and the ebbs and flows of that. So you can see in 1994 it hit the peak of 17.9%, and the low was in 2010 at 14.7%. So again, this changes for a number of reasons. It's impacted by the revenues collected, but also the personal income forecast also has the measure changes with those. And what I thought I'd do was provide a snapshot of what we were projecting with the February forecast about what was going to happen for the price of government between fiscal year 13 and fiscal year 15. And what we saw based on the February forecast was that the price of government was projected to decline to 14.7% by 2015. And this provides a breakdown by your major taxes and also non-tax revenues and gives the aggregate total so you can see where the movements were. And the thing I really wanted to highlight is that forecast revenues, as you can see, the total owned source revenues, total own source revenues were expected to grow by 4%. However, personal income over that same time period was projected to grow by 8.5%. So it's that dynamic between revenue growth and personal income growth that really is driving, in this case, the price of government to go down, and that the personal income metric is growing faster than revenues were projected with the November forecast. Now, if we look at what happened during session and the impact of session with the increases in income and other taxes, and also the effect of lower property taxes, we still see the price of government going down relative to what it is in fiscal 14, but not as much. So the February forecast, we're expecting it to be 14.7%. If nothing else happened, if no laws were passed, that's what we would have projected it to be. And the end result, based on the end of session, hasn't been updated with anything since that time, is that it'll be 15.1% by the end of 2015. And so here you can see the impact of the various laws that passed this session and how that impacts the price of government. And again, we'll forecast it again in November, and also with the February and then any other governor's budget that comes out.
So the income tax on the highest earners wasn't increased So that was a significant part of the differential.
Correct. Yeah. So again, this is just looking at fiscal 15. So it's not the total biennial change. It's just looking at the increase in the new tax bracket.
But of that change, half of it was from taxing people at the very high end, and part of it was, I suppose, a cigarette tax.
Correct. So that's probably a good thing to point out is under other taxes, the 688, over half of that is the cigarette tax, and also the conversion of the health impact fee, converting that into a tax. So that's why you see other taxes increasing pretty significantly, but you see under non-tax revenues the decrease of $159 million. That's largely because of that technical adjustment from a fee to a fee.
So that 2% on the other taxes, half of that cigarette tax, and another big portion is taxes people were already paying. We're just calling it something. We're actually finally calling it a tax instead of a fee.
Yeah, that the major driver between other taxes and non-tax revenues, again, is the switching of the HIF.
That's offset by a reduction in the property taxes.
Correct. So under statewide and local property tax, you're seeing the impact of the additional aids provided to localities.
Okay. President Holbert.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, so are you making the assumption that with the property tax relief that the property tax will go down that same dollar amount in the local municipalities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I don't know exactly the ratio at which it is, if it's a one-for-one, but again, based on session and working with the Department of Revenue, we get from the Department of Revenue is where we get the estimates for the cities and counties and townships. And based on the result of session that they were projecting, the city or state and school district property taxes to decrease.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, so you don't know what factor was put into the end of session numbers that you're showing on the graph as far as how much of the local property tax relief, I guess it's called, if any, would be levied back as well?
I don't, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I don't have that number available to me in terms of the exact impact, but I can get that to you.
I can't remember what the, for some reason, half is stuck in my head. Half of the aid would go toward, is assumed to go towards property tax relief, and the other half is not assumed to go there. It's to go to, you know,
more
spending on police and firefighters and teachers and those kind of things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, I would say that also we will, you know, obviously this was with end of session estimates, and right, we'll update with the November forecast. And
we'll find out if that ratio, we should find out if that ratio has changed. That was my last recollection.
All right, thank you.
The last thing I wanted to finish up with, unless there's any other questions, is just to highlight the point of the sensitivity of the price of government. So on this slide, I highlighted the change over time of the own source revenues and also personal income, and you can see from year to year the change that's occurred for those two metrics. And the one thing I just wanted to highlight was that since 2003, or since the chart begins, the average annual growth for local own source revenues has been 3.9%, while for the personal income metric, the average annual growth has been 4.3%. So if that trend continues, if we would see that difference, that personal income is growing slightly faster than state and local revenues, we would expect the price of government to continue to decline.
And if we just go back to the earlier chart, by 2017, at least the projections under the way law is currently set up, we'd be at the lowest price of government we've ever been at. At 14.6.
Yes, that would be
since
correct.
Since we started measuring.
Given current projections, that's correct.
Mr. Speaker.
Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think we have to be a little bit careful on saying that it's the lowest percentage price of government when on, even though it's a lower percentage, it's on a higher amount. And what we're looking at is the largest tax collection in state history of about another $4.73 billion. So even though the percentage might be going down a little bit, it's on a much larger number. And so we're taking another $4.73 billion more from Minnesotans than we ever have before. So I think we need to be just a little careful on, you know, maybe patting ourselves on the back just a little bit, saying that, oh, the cost of government's gone down, while the price of government has gone way, way up. Would that be an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, again, yes. In terms of looking at the numbers, it is important to recognize the relationship between the base, the personal income, how that changes relative to the numerator. So as one increases and the other increase, that correct, you have to remember the relationship is important.
I mean,
and then
Mr. Speaker,
the other question has to do with the property tax issue a little bit here. I read in the paper every day back home, the Post Bulletin, different papers, about how many school districts are going with the automatic $300 increase that they can do per pupil unit. And, of course, that gets put on the property tax. Do we have there been any calculations made on an estimate of how many school districts have done that and how many cities have raised their levies to the maximum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, at this time, I don't have that information. I know the Department of Education, they have to certify the levies in early November, I believe, and the final number. So at this time, we don't. We will know a lot more come the November forecast when we have final levy information from both the school districts and the cities.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Davids. The other thing that would play into the question that you just asked about the school levies is there was a significant increase in equalizing. So it wouldn't be necessarily a property tax impact, but it would be an impact on the state dollars because of the equalizing that was added. And then the other point I wanted to make is these numbers that we're looking at on this graph, as Representative David pointed out, are non-inflation adjusted numbers. So the total number goes up, but the percentage goes down. And if you were to adjust for inflation, then the relative number would also be going down.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
So who, Mr. Marks, Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chair, members, this is the handout that says state spending trends, various perspectives on it, and Mr. Nauman helped prepare this. Mr. Nauman's not here today, okay. So I get to do it.
Wonderful.
This is looking at the same information that we presented to the commission back in March, and it's updating it for the end of session information. The first page in the handout is a lot of numbers, and I realize those might not be the easiest things to read, certainly not on the screen, but they are the numbers that are the basis for each of the charts that follow. And there are four graphs that follow. The first set of numbers is for the first one, the second for the second one, and so on. So stepping to the graphs, the first graph is looking, this is looking at state expenditures in all funds. So this is the broad array of funds. The light blue color, or the lower section of the bar on each graph, is the general fund. The purple or the darker area on the upper part is other funds. The single biggest chunk of that is probably federal funds. Trunk highway funds would also be in that category. So this first graph, which says expenditures, all funds, is looking at just the raw numbers, no adjustments for inflation or anything. And going back to fiscal 1998 and showing the trends over time, you can see that in general the bars grow as the years go by. There are fiscal 12 as an example where it's a little bit lower overall, and general fund happens to drop in fiscal 10. But this basically, the trend overall, we've also added fiscal year 16 and 17 here, which were not here in the past. Just for reference for a number, for fiscal 13, for example, the number here is $18,426,000,000. And you can see where that is on the that's the general fund portion only, $33,248,000,000 for the all fund spending. Up through fiscal 17, it's $37,646,000,000. So just a perspective on that. The next graph is taking the same numbers but adjusting it for inflation. The inflation adjustment in this case is the consumer price index. And we've indexed it so fiscal year 13 is the 100% number. So it's adjusting earlier years to the fiscal 13 spending level and later years to the fiscal 13 level as well. But assuming fiscal 13 as the 100% level, you can see this flattens out the bars considerably. The consumer price index numbers in here just give you some sense. In recent years, fiscal 10 is 1.6%, fiscal 11 3.2, fiscal 12 2.1, fiscal 13 is 1.5, as is fiscal 14, and 15 is 1.6%. So some sense of what the adjustment is in here, but it's taking the same numbers as in the previous chart and making an adjustment for inflation. The third graph takes the spending numbers, again, it'd be the numbers from graph one, and adjusts it for population, what would be Minnesota population numbers. So it's a per capita chart. And we've updated the population numbers a little bit since the March presentation with the population numbers through years 2010 are from the U.S. Census Bureau. Years 2011 through 2017 are estimates from the Minnesota State Demographic Center projections. So they're the estimates for what Minnesota population is going to be. Again, you can see the numbers there. It's not flattened as much as a consumer price index adjustment does, but it does make an adjustment to the rate at which the percentages or the numbers change. And then the final chart in here adjusts for both factors. It adjusts for population and for inflation. And you can see that this makes the chart, the numbers, the bars considerably flatter. It tends to even things out over the years considerably more when both adjustments are applied. Again, the inflation adjustment in here would be the same as the previous one. It's making fiscal 13 the 100% year as far as making the adjustments here. So Mr. Chair, those are the sets of numbers. I can try to answer any questions if there are any.
And we just wanted to update, since we did this last spring, to see where things are since this session. So any discussion? President Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your all funds numbers going out into 16 and 17, do they reflect the sequestration numbers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert, they reflect the best estimates of the state agencies for federal funds being received. So I'm assuming that they would have built that in, but I can't say that for sure. I don't know if Mr. Baumtrau can comment on that, but they're the federal funds numbers from the consolidated fund statement, so they would be the numbers that state agencies are estimating for federal funds as of the end of the legislative session. So I assume MMB would have given agencies instructions to make those kind of estimates.
Mr. Chair,
I
would just add or echo what Bill said about when they were presented. We did, when we were putting the governor's budget together and when agencies were updating what they thought they would receive from the federal government, we did highlight the issue of sequestration and ask them to plan for or to contact their federal agency in terms of planning. But again, sequestration and the timeline has changed over that time period, too.
So we don't know for sure. I think we can try to find out.
Chair, I'm a little confused. So MMB did not give a specific direction to back out sequestration dollars in calendar 14 and 15. It's my understanding January 1st, a whole new round of deeper cuts goes into effect. Most likely these numbers don't reflect any of that. Is that your best direction?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, we didn't specifically tell agencies to take out sequestration impacts are 5.4% across the board because it wasn't clear at the time when we were updating that that was going to be the case. But we did ask agencies to prepare as much as they could or put their best guess with their working with their federal agencies.
Okay. And so if I might, I know I could probably find it here, but so of the other funds, all other funds, what percentage of that is federal funds?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mark. Holberg, I don't have the exact percentage here. I can get that to you. Okay. It's a significant share, but I need to look it up to be sure.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. So now on to the advisory groups. So we did meet some Representative Holberg and Senator Sieben and Senator Newman and I met for, I don't know, a couple hours, a couple weeks ago, and went through a number of agencies. And so attached or in your packets are the recommendations for a number of agencies that you can see here. And the recommendations are either, you know, get rid of it or task force, or we should keep this, or we need to look at it further. And a lot of the further is what we'll be doing today. But I thought one thing we could do is just kind of, I don't know if we need to make an official motion, but kind of move this document as our base document, and then we can make edits to it as we go along as a way of tracking through this, if that makes sense. So, you know, as we go through these agencies, and then we can kind of at the end of the day make a preliminary adoption of some of these recommendations. But I do want to thank Mary Liz and Katie and Scott for their putting the time in to go through this, and Kate Pruszek, who's actually done most of the work on this, joyfully, I'm sure. So, so Department of Commerce, why don't we just start there? And some of these are on the list for further review, not because we think that they should actually be eliminated or we have questions. I mean, some of them are actually doing some good work, and it would be good to hear of task forces. I think we can learn something from hearing from some groups that are actually doing some positive work, and we'll get to some of those here as we move through it, too. Welcome.
Mr. Speaker, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm going to be speaking today about the Automobile Theft Prevention Advisory Board. First, just a little bit of background for members if you're not familiar with the Auto Theft Prevention Grant Program. The program was established by the legislature in 1996 and has been fully administered by the Insurance Fraud Bureau at the Commerce Department since 2009. The program is funded from a 50-cent surcharge on per vehicle for every 6 months of insurance sold in the state. And using that funding, which is a special revenue account, the program makes grants available through a competitive process for activities that address the problem of auto theft. The statute lays out some requirements for what types of uses these grants can be used for. I'll list them for you. Identification of critical law enforcement issues related to auto theft education for law enforcement officers and citizens, investigation and prosecution of auto theft suspects, collaboration between law enforcement agencies working to reduce auto theft, and prevention of auto thefts resulting in lower auto insurance premiums. In the last biennium, the Commerce Department made over $3.7 million in grants out of the program, which was both the largest dollar amount granted out of the program, as well as it was to the largest number of grant recipients. That went over the course of three grant RFPs during the course of the biennium. Part of the reason for why we had more dollars available in the last biennium than in previous bienniums is that a insurer had been underreporting into the fund and so made a lump sum payment into the account so there were more dollars available. Commissioner Rothman made it a priority to try to get those dollars into the field to law enforcement and prosecutorial agencies who could apply and were eligible. And that actually was indicative to us as at the Commerce Department as to the need for this program going forward, because we were the request for total for grant funds far exceeded the total amount that we were able to actually grant out of the program, and that showed that there was continued interest across the state in this program. As to the advisory board itself, the board consists of members from auto insurers, law enforcement, and the public, and the board helps advise the commissioner on dispersal of the grants. And so the way that the process works is that the RFP goes out, RFP responses come back in from applicants, and the advisory board helps score those grants. That information is very useful to the commissioner in making grant allocations. We have the questions from the committee, and I think that certainly the board has fulfilled its mission and continues to fulfill its mission. Members are eligible to receive per diem, although over the last 2 years, members have not received per diem payments. There is no additional funding that comes through for this board. We do think that it provides a valuable service and has been an effective way for the agency to obtain expert advice and opinions from the various groups that are represented by board members. And in the absence of the board, we do think that we would have a much more difficult time obtaining the viewpoints and input of those various stakeholders, which all have a different stake in preventing auto theft in Minnesota. So we believe that the board works well as currently designed and would be supportive of it continuing in the future. I'm happy to answer any questions and work with members of this committee and the Commerce Committees if there's interest in it evolving over time.
And these are public meetings because it's a task force? Is that the rule?
Mr. Speaker, yes. The board traditionally meets once each grant cycle. We ask them to do the scoring, and takes different people different amounts of time, so we usually give folks a deadline to complete their scoring work, and then the board usually meets to compare notes and to understand how they're applying their thought process uniformly.
I think one of our thoughts on this one is our analysis says that the advisory task was actually expired in 2009 by automatically under a law we passed. But the question here is whether we would actually recommend that we continue the board going forward. So the commissioner could pull these people together on his own anyway, I suppose. And so so it is meeting, but having it in statute actually gives a little more protection because it's there's more public transparency, arguably, around it. So I think that's what – I don't know, Representative Holberg, do you remember – was that the question that we had is – for this one is because it's actually expired. The section is so it's really a question of whether we want to continue it or change. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I guess the point was that it is expired.
Right.
It's still meeting, so either I would guess in maybe your technical bill next year you should make it official if you need it to continue to exist.
Representative Bob.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And on groups that are advising on the allocation of grant funding, I really actually think it's better to have it in statute to make sure there's, the kind of right balance. And I think that gives people more faith that our grant programs are actually administered with, fair input from across the state and different people who are interested in the issue. I don't know what the exact makeup is of this group, but we don't always give advisor groups that responsibility, but when we do, when they're actually making serious recommendations about the allocation of significant funds, I think it's good to keep it in statute to make sure that that group is representative of the interests that we think should be at the table.
Any further discussion on this one? So, I guess my sense is we should recommend that it continue and that we make a change in law so that it's actually officially in law. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague to talk about the real estate appraiser board.
And just for background, so in 2009, I guess we passed a law that basically sunsetted everything automatically unless it was not sunsetted or had some other provision in law. And so this kind of was one that got caught up in that we're just going to sunset everything land. And so and we'll see a couple more of those as we go forward here. Thank you. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure about the process. I know that the working group recommended repealing a number of others within the agency. So are you here to testify on those recommendations as well, or not sure how we move forward with?
Right. I thought, I thought that we would hear from ones we wanted, the specific ones we wanted to hear from, and then at the end for each agency, we'd ask if they had any other quibbles with our recommendations. So why don't we go to the real estate board, and then we can come back to that at the end.
Great. Thank you. My name is Allison Grebner, Assistant Director of Government Affairs at Commerce. I'm going to discuss with you a bit about the Real Estate Appraiser Advisory Board. So the Real Estate Appraiser Advisory Board mission has been satisfied. The advisory group has played an important role in making recommendations on the experience, examination, education requirements for real estate appraisers, and the periodic review of the standards. This is especially true in the 1990s when the industry was largely unregulated and Minnesota decided to take proactive steps towards establishing guidelines for real estate appraisers. Since that time, the federal government has played an increasingly larger role in regulating real estate appraisers. A majority of our current state law is actually federal conformity, including required education credentials, a uniform national exam, and experience hours. In fact, during this past legislative session, the department carried federal conformity language, which was signed into law and will go into effect in 2015. The advisory group does not have a specific budget. However, we don't believe that has impaired the group's ability to function in that the Department of Commerce employees are the ones that staff the advisory group. The advisory group, as I mentioned, has provided the agency with efficient and effective expert advice and opinion over the years. In lieu of the advisory group, the stakeholders could contact the Department of Commerce at any time. However, there wouldn't be a specified forum at which to do so. The department, as I mentioned, believes that the advisory board's scope has been met. With the federal government taking a more active role in the industry, the opportunities for the department to need the advice as the original charge was given has been lessened. At this time, the department has no further recommendations to improve the group's efficiency and effectiveness.
Any questions people have on that? Any thoughts?
Oh, okay. Mr. Chair, I guess I would move that we put that in the repeal column.
Right. Any discussion on that? Okay. So of the rest of these, does the department have any position on the rest of the agencies? Or recommendations, I guess, or task forces?
Mr. Speaker, I don't think so at this time. I think there are some of them on the list with which we have interactions with the same stakeholders on similar issues or the same issue in other forms. And so I think rather than go through them here, I think we'd be happy to work with the committee to provide you more information about other practices that the department has that may overlap that continue to inform the development of a bill that the committee may be putting forward to look at some of these. I don't think that, for example, the Renewable Hydrogen Initiative Advisory Committee I don't believe has ever met under the statute, so I don't think we have any objection with that one. But some of the others, we'd be happy to provide that information offline to members and to staff.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Any further discussion on the task force? I guess the two are the Energy Advisory Task Force and the Research and Education Advisory Committee, which we don't know when they last met. Whether we want to make, if we just want to recommend their repeal too.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think some of these are already expired. So I don't think we have to take action if they're already repealed, right?
Right. Not those two, though.
Well, Mr. Chair, yeah. I think it still takes some action to just get them off of the books and clean up the books. And so just pull them out of the statute books. Because they sit there expired, you know, some of these for...
Just cross them out. But. Mm-hmm. Good, but it didn't. All right. I'm really not hearing anything strongly. Yeah, Representative Carl. Chairman,
just a question. You indicated at the beginning how you wanted to proceed, and I... Did you need a motion from somebody that was on that working group? And then you said something about amending the
right.
So the overall motion, but it probably should come from somebody that was on the working group is what my thought was.
So the two kind of ambiguous ones in this chart here right now are the Energy Advisory Task Force and the Energy Research, where we wanted to seek some agency input. And I don't know that we've heard anything particularly on those. And they haven't met. So I guess I would move that we recommend the repeal. I don't know if I can do that, though, as the chair. That's
well, I'll move it then that we repeal them based on the fact that they haven't met.
And we're sending these to the we'll send these to the committees all the to look at. So any discussion on that? Okay. We'll move it kind of informally here, but that's okay. That's good. All right, so that's where we are for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Deed. We... only have one. So most of these, indeed, as you can see, are actually required by federal law, so there's not a whole lot we can... We don't have a lot of discretion there anyway.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I don't see any green highlighting, so I don't think we need to hear from them. And other than that last one, it looks like they responded that they'd like to get rid of it.
They want to get rid of it. So should we just put a repeal on there?
I would... Okay. I think that makes sense.
I think it.
What's it called?
The Youth Employment Grants Advisory Committee.
Youth Employment Grants Advisory Committee. Okay.
All right. Why don't we mark down a repeal as we move through here?
I know.
All right. So IRRB, we don't have anything highlighted here.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
On that one, I was confused because in the comment section, it says combined with Northeast Minnesota Economic Development Fund, and then under that fund, it says combined with Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection, and I'm wondering if they are, but they're statutorily still separate, and I'm wondering if one of our recommendations should be to update the statutes to reflect that into one entity, since that's apparently how they're functioning.
As I understand it, it's the same people serving on both. So I, you know, we're kind of deferring a little bit on these. That's what we're checking with the agency on, as to whether Commissioner Sertich and others think that it would make sense to change the statute. And I don't think we've gotten a response back yet.
Nope. Okay, thanks.
All right. Dolly. The subgroup or the sub whatever suggested that we keep all of those, right? Is that right? Yeah. And some changes were made in that area under the Sunset Commission previously. So the PUC, is someone here from the PUC? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Dan Wolf. I'm the Assistant Executive Secretary at the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, and I brought with me the manager of the Facilities and Permitting Unit, since both of the advisory groups or task force that you have under consideration at this time both deal with 216E, which is the siting and permitting of large electric energy facilities. And Mr. Eknas can introduce himself, but he's the manager of the group that works directly with these two types of task forces.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Thiessen and Commission members. My name is Brett Eknas. I'm the manager of the Facilities Permitting Unit on the Commission. And we operate under the statute that is in question today. The Commission has two task forces. The first is the advisory task force, which is appointed by the commission on a project-by-project basis. When we look at the project, we say, how difficult overall do we expect it to be? What's the population density? What are the geographic features of the area? The amount of development going near the, say, the transmission line or the generation site. And then the level of public interest and public opposition. The task force is a way for the commission to reach out to the community and get some input from local government officials and landowners and members of the public in the area of the proposed project. Now, the commission doesn't do it very often. When it does do it, it delegates the authority to the Department of Commerce. Given resource issues, they delegate that responsibility to the Department of Commerce, who then oversees the charge, usually hires a facilitator from the Department of Administration, and then that facilitator then conducts usually 2 to 3 meetings, and then they develop a report, which will recommend different environmental factors to be examined, given some local characteristics, and then also different routes, route alternatives to be studied in the environmental review document, whether it's an environmental assessment or an environmental impact statement. The second advisory task force that the commission oversees is a scientific advisory task force, and that the commission has actually, we've had the authority over power plant siting since 2005, and we have not used the scientific advisory task force. But what that group would do if it was to be formulated would be research and then make recommendations to the commission on specific issues that the commission asked for them to look into further.
And so these are not the same people on each task force. They change depending on the plan or the proposal. They're appointed specific to each project, and then that task force goes away, and if there's another project, it's a different group.
Yeah, that is correct. And then the scientific one, I think, would be more academics, that kind of stuff, less public participation on that.
Any questions? Representative or Senator Scoy.
Thank you. How large a plant would you be looking at in order for these advisory groups to be called together? I was curious, there was a proposal for that natural gas plant up in Chisago Lakes area a number of years ago. I think it was 850 megawatts. Would have that risen to the size requirement to call one of these advisory groups?
Mr. Eckes.
Chair Thiessen and Representative, certainly it's a large enough project that it would, and it did seem to me, if I remember right, it did have a lot of local opposition to its development. It's not necessarily based on size, but oftentimes the bigger it gets, the more opposition that it has. That project never made it to the commission as a proposal, one way or the other, either as a certificate of need or for a site permit. So I couldn't say for sure what we would do. The commission can take up the option of setting up an advisory task force on its own, and then also citizens and others can petition to ask the commission to go ahead and do that.
And so, but that very or could have been potentially an example of a use for these advisory citizens.
Mr. Eckert.
Chair Thiessen, member. Yes, absolutely.
And the one that's in the letter, you said the last one that they used was for the Hollydale, but this is a power line, right? That wasn't a plant, even.
Yes, that's a transmission line.
Any further questions? Representative Carl?
Yeah, just maybe I could ask, Mr. Chairman, if you could tell me what the difference between these two task forces would be. I'm looking at the first one, and I would assume if you were talking about siting a plant, you'd also want scientific information. So why do we split those out? It would appear to me one task force would probably suffice, and My point is that you would need scientific information for the first one as well.
Mr. Reckless.
Chair Thiessen and Representative
Carlson.
Carlson, sorry. The difference would be, you know, that we would use the task force in a particular project to either look at different sites for placing the generation or different routes for siting the transmission line. That would consist of you know, four or so local government officials, and then the rest would be landowners that are potentially affected by the project or members of the public in the general area. The scientific one would not look at a particular project, but more or less a particular issue. And I think the statute itself uses a couple of examples for what it would be used for, and that would be things like undergrounding or double circuiting and other health and safety kinds of issues.
And if one is issue-oriented and the other is site, I was interpreting them both as being involved with the siting of a plant, but you're saying the other is more issue-oriented. Okay, that's fine then. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
So any thoughts on this? It seems like we'll probably keep this in statute. This authority? Yeah. Okay. Any objections to that? All right. The Minnesota Racing Commission, the Breeder Fund Advisory Committee, this advises on the use of the Breeder's Fund, and we're not quite exactly sure, but we recommended that we keep it.
What is the Breeder Fund?
It's the money they use to increase purses at the track at Canterbury, and I don't know about the other one. And then they also spread some of the money is used to build the infrastructure for racing, sort of, you know, people that race horses and that kind of stuff. That's about as deep as. Do you have more to add?
Well, and Mr. Chair, the money also comes from a tax for admissions to gaming, so they collect it and kind of spread it around and.
Yes, the tax on at the horse track.
But Mr. Chair, again, that's has to do with the Breeders' Fund itself. This is we're talking about the advisory committee and
so that they get input
exactly
right.
on how to properly use the Breeders' Fund. And, but that's a thing that we need to make sure we don't get that we keep the distinction because I mean we're not going to be recommending we get rid of the Breeders' Fund. It's whether.
Or
an
advisory committee in this case.
Exactly, or the advisory committee in this case, but...
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so they advise on how that money's spread around. All right, Department of Corrections. Let's see. So the only one, there were two that we had some questions about. I don't think they're here. One, I had the Correction Facility Site Selection Task Force. Because they're not looking at building any new prisons, that you can see the department said we're okay repealing that one.
Mm-hmm.
So I suggest, unless there's objection, that we do that. Okay. And then there's something on the on advisory task force for sex offender treatment. We're waiting for a response. I just suggest we don't get into that one at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So we just keep it. Okay. Any objection there? All right, Department of Public Safety. We have a couple to go through there. Hi. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Rayon Magnuson. I am the Executive Director for the Office of Justice Programs for the Department of Public Safety. I've been in that position since July of this year, so fairly new. Some of you know me from my work previously to that. I was the Executive Director for Women's Advocates for 10 years, working with victims of domestic violence. I'm going to address the Battered Women's Advisory Council, which is an interesting position for me, being in this new position, because I did work with the council in the field. The Office of Justice does believe that the mission of the advisory group is fully satisfied. From the records that I could find and the staff I talked to, the council has not been active since about 2000 in its form as it was legislated. That was a couple of reasons. I could say it was only budget, but that is not true. There was no budget for this advisory council, so that's only part of the reason. The other reason was primarily it was set up to assist the commissioner and the Office of Justice Programs to help really decide on RFP processes when there were new funding, give them feedback on evaluation, and really help develop best practices in the community. And what happened was there was a 12-member advisory council at one point. It was supposed to be representative of the state. That was an issue. It tended to be more metro-focused. And secondly, the people on the council were not supposed to be directly receiving funds from the Office of Justice, or at least not sit and make those decisions regarding funding, and that indeed happened. So there were many conflicts of interest. But just moving on from the statute from 1977, very, very important that a group of people does come together, that there is stakeholder input, and how the Office of Justice Programs has done that, at least for the last 10 years, is we've worked very closely with the Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women, also the sexual assault groups. We've worked privately with individual nonprofits, and I feel, again, I could speak both as a previous provider and now in the director's role, that we have established really great not only relationships but partnerships with these groups where we regularly get input and ideas for the work we do, which I'm much appreciative of. And just specifically so you know, I'll just take a couple minutes, a couple examples. The Office of Justice did a competitive funding process in 2012. It was quite controversial because it had not been a competitive process prior to that time. And to do that, again, they worked with the statewide coalitions with sexual assault, domestic violence. They worked with providers in developing that RFP process. And it took a good year to develop that and really make it solid so that it was workable. And I can report, again, that that went relatively well. There, of course, were some people that were unhappy, but it was a very thorough process. Another thing that we've done, again, with our staff and mostly working with the coalitions is, excuse me, again, in about 2011, the Office of Justice took on themselves, this wasn't legislated, to develop best practices and guidelines for domestic violence shelters in the state of Minnesota. And they did that again with working with providers and the Minnesota Battered Women's Coalition and the Sexual Assault Coalitions to work together to determine those best practices. And I can tell you right now that those are all instituted in the domestic violence shelters throughout the state, working pretty well, still needs work. But Minnesota is one of the few states, I think five, that actually has best practices and standards for shelters. So basically what I'm saying is our staff have incorporated the work. I feel we have great relationships in the community to get the input and the feedback that we need. It's still in statute under 611 that there's a process to get feedback for the RFP process. It's just not this council. So basically the language we'd suggest could go, could be sunsetted as far as the actual council. And as I mentioned, it hasn't been active for at least 12 years, perhaps longer.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With your new process that you have in place, kind of going back to Representative Loeffler's comments about if we're giving out grant money, are there public meetings, are there notices? Is this new process notice so that anybody that wants to participate can attend? Does it meet those standards, I guess?
Chairman Thiessen, Representative Holbert, excuse me. It's an excellent question. Yes, there is. Again, we have a great listserv that we can get out to the community, both the nonprofits, other government entities, as well as we use, again, the statewide coalitions to get that word out. And we feel that works pretty effectively.
And Mr. Chair, where do you hold your meetings? Do you hold them in a public place, centrally located, or?
Chairman Thiessen and Representative Holbert, normally we would pick a place in the community. It would not be at the Office of Justice Programs. With the best practices, feedback and dialogue that happened, we often met at the Minnesota Battered Women's Coalition, or they would find a meeting place for us in the community that was big enough. Also, we focused on communities of color. Again, we were looking for, we expanded our funding again this year, thanks to the legislature, to specifically meet unmet needs in the community, specifically people of color organizations and underserved populations. So those meetings were held throughout the community.
And, Mr. Chair,
excuse me.
Are all of the processes and procedures for distributing grant funds, are the documents public if somebody wanted to come in and see all the applications and wanted to track or write a story about how the decisions were made and what priorities were given to various applications in order that they get money or not? Would somebody be able to find all that information?
Chairman Thiessen and Representative Holberg, again, an excellent question. That's one of the first things I ask coming in into the office. We actually have a great process that's been set up again that involves a two-part review process, and so people are invited to review. This is specifically crime victim grants, so we might have 6 to 8 people reviewing a set of Metro grants, another 6 to 8 people reviewing other grants. So it's a group process. They make that recommendation. Then our staff takes a second level. That information would be public, not all the specific comments that a person might make, say individually if you volunteered, but a summary of that would be available. A list of grantees is always available. And as far as if you are denied funding, again, that information we would share with you as far as why that was and where you ranked and that sort of thing. So we could definitely make it available upon request.
And, Mr. Chair, would you make that also available to the public if somebody, say, if a reporter came and they wanted to do a story on how you spent your $1 million and why Shelter A got money and Shelter B didn't? Would they be able to get that information and know how people voted on where the money was distributed?
Chairman Thiessen and Representative Holberg, no, that would probably not be politically correct. We would, again, be very careful of what we shared to protect the volunteer's identity. Again, I would, I'm just using you as an example. If you volunteered to be a reviewer, that information we would not share. Specific information about an agency, I mean, anything that's public information, of course, we would share about the program, the budget, that sort of thing. But we just would not throw it out there for the press to look at. No, we would be discreet about that. Does that answer your question?
Well, it doesn't. It kind of raises the issue of if you're having a advisory meeting that has is subject to open meeting and you have a discussion and a rating system, all of that happens in the public realm. Mm-hmm. It sounds that you have internalized this process. And somebody may not even be able to get the names of the people that did the review to be able to check for conflict of interest. Mm. So I'm just, I mean, it's a balance here. We're trying to get rid of some of these groups, but in turn, we don't want all of these policies and procedures so internalized to the agencies that we lose the element of accountability and sunshine in the process with public dollars. And it's a balance, and I'm just curious.
Chairman Thiessen and Representative, those are really, really good questions. Yes, we would absolutely try to balance it. I'm being careful in that it's protective in that the reviewers, there's a lot of notes, there's a lot of conversation that goes on with the ranking. So there's criteria that they rank the grants on. That is kept, it's stored, it would be shared with the agency. You as another agency, if you came in and said, what did my proposal look like? How did I compare? We would share that normally again in summary form about all the agencies, but these are hundreds of pages long, so we wouldn't share every small detail. It's certainly available, though. If you wanted to come in, we'd welcome you. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that the issue of, you know, making sure that the public believes that there's fairness in our process can be dealt with through an advisory committee of experts who are transparent in their meetings and do those things. But I think our state agencies issue thousands of RFPs that are scored by groups that they put together of experts or people with knowledge in that field. And maybe what we need to just have is some blanket policy, and maybe it's already in statute under, I know some years ago there was an effort to try and more standardize and professionalize our grants process, and maybe we need to have some more generic kind of policies, because I think there are lots of RFPs and grant dollars awarded without advisory committees ever having been set in statute. And I think sometimes some things you really need some really technical expertise that there may not be that many people in the state that have, and then there's other things that have a broad constituency. My bigger concern is when we get into working too closely with the industry that benefits, and so that it really is, you know, those who are most benefiting financially in the past, and sometimes that can create some real resistance to letting in newcomers in new areas, new populations, and I think we need to guard against that. But maybe we should look at some of the general policies, because I think that it goes beyond those that have ever had advisory committees.
Anyone else?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would move that we repeal this. It's not meeting or anything. I'm just a little concerned that what has happened since 1999 may not have been the most public process.
Right. So, I mean, right. I mean, the other alternative, I don't know how this is different in terms of makeup than what they're doing internally. So.
And, Mr. Chair, I was first elected in 98, and in 99 served on Judiciary Finance in my freshman term, and I remember this controversy now as you've talked about it, and it was pretty ugly within the community, and so I don't think that this group functioned effectively and get rid of it, but hopefully maybe some of the people that serve on the Judiciary Finance Committee can maybe find spend a little more time and make sure there's enough sunshine in the process in the future.
And there may be something to what Representative Loeffler is suggesting, too. In terms of, I don't know what our Data Practices Act says, but some of this. So, okay. Any other discussion on that? All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Let's see. Financial crimes. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the commission. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the assistant superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and with me is Assistant Commissioner Danaski of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. I'm here to address the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force and the Advisory Board. The Minnesota Financial Crimes Advisory Board is a statutorily created advisory board under the statutes of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And that board is comprised of members of state, local, and federal law enforcement, members of the federal prosecutorial community, members of the county prosecutorial community, members of the legislature, and members from retail and banking. Their primary mission and purpose is to provide advice to the Commissioner of Public Safety on investigation of identity theft and financially related crimes, in addition to spending the appropriations that are appropriated to fund the investigation of financial crimes in the state of Minnesota, which is done through the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension currently is providing operational and administrative support to the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force on behalf of the Department of Public Safety. That task force is currently comprised of members of the law enforcement community to investigate financial crimes throughout the state of Minnesota. Primarily, they concentrate on complex, multi-jurisdictional financial frauds and financial crimes cases. Currently, there's a $300,000 general fund appropriation that is used entirely to fund task force operations. The money is not used to fund the advisory board. It's used to fund the task force operations. And currently, that $300,000 is utilized to fund the commander of the statewide financial crimes task force,
two criminal intelligence analysts that are employed for the Financial Crimes Task Force, and then there's four participating agencies that are funded through those funds. The Edina Police Department has a member assigned to this task force who's funded partially through this appropriation. Minneapolis Police Department is funded partially through this appropriation. Duluth Police Department and then the Mille Lacs County Sheriff's Office each have a member that's partially funded through this appropriation. In addition to that, there's additional members. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has two agents that are assigned that are funded by the agency on the task force. The Ramsey County Sheriff's Office has a member that they fund participating in the task force. In addition to heavy support from the United States Secret Service, the IRS Criminal Investigative Division, and then on a case-by-case basis, the Postal Inspection Service provide members to investigate various crimes. So the as noted, they primarily work on complex, multi-jurisdictional financial frauds and financial crimes investigations. Most recently, working on an insider bank fraud case that we recently had an operation in the last month executing 21 search warrants that involved over 100 law enforcement officers from 21 different jurisdictions. So while there is a core group of members of the task force that conduct these financial crimes investigations, they often leverage partnerships throughout the law enforcement community depending on the operation that they're conducting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if it's just the common nomenclature in law enforcement investigations. I've heard task force used like this where it's an operational investigative group of people who are brought together because of their specialized skills. But what we're really looking at mostly are task forces that are put together to give us short-term advice on something. And maybe we need to think about whether that's the best name, because I don't even know that a review of whether it should exist is our jurisdiction. That's more the policy committees for the actual task force with the investigators.
I think the reason this is here, Senator Newman had a question about why we have an advisory committee and a task force.
Both.
It seems like the task force is the doers and the advisory committee is like the board of directors. Is that a fair analogy?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that's a fair analogy. The advisory board provides advice to the commissioner, who then provides the operational oversight of the task force. So it's a true advisory board providing input on the use of the funds and direction and what the task force should be concentrating on.
I think the task force probably doesn't fall within our purview, but that's... There's some confusion because they're in the same statute and they sound like something. So, mm-hmm. Any further discussion on this one that people have? Okay, thank you. And so I think we want to keep these. Okay, unless there's objection to that. All right, fire.
Mr. Chair, once again, my name is Mark Danaski. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. One of the council's advisory groups that you have listed is the Fire Protection Systems Advisory Council. The council was established to provide advice to the Commissioner on Public Safety on matters within the council's expertise, particularly with fire protection. They were established under 299M.02 in 1992 with that process in mind. It's primarily served to assist with the development of administrative rules governing the installation of fire protection equipment. In consultation with the Office of the State Fire Marshal, they believe that they have the ability to draw on expertise within the community and within the industry to advise and establish those rules and codes as they move along. And so the department does recommend that this council does be eliminated.
Any discussion on that?
So moved.
Okay, we'll add that. All right. And are you also on the Fire Service Advisory Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I am. The Fire Service Advisory Committee was one of those that, Mr. Chair, you alluded to earlier that unexpectedly expired on June 30th of 2009 with the sunset legislation. The Fire Service Advisory Committee provides recommendations to the Commissioner of Public Safety on fire service-related issues. It also provides funding recommendations to the Commissioner of Public Safety from the Fire Safety Fund for the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training and Education, the programs and staffing for the State Fire Marshal Division, and fire-related regional response team programs, or any other fire service programs that have the potential for statewide impact. There is no budget associated with this advisory group. And based on, they have continued to meet, which is a little different than the document that you have. They have continued to meet on their regular basis. And it's my understanding from the last meeting of that group that there probably will be legislation coming forth this year to either reinstate them or reestablish that group.
So we want to keep it? Is that consensus here?
Or? Well, Mr. Chair, I don't. It's not officially. It's not. So we're not really keeping it.
We'd have to take action and put it back in the statute. Right. So the question is whether people want it to continue to be expired or whether we want to take action to move forward, keep it going forward.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we need to have it in place because it distributes that fire safety account money that's no longer going to the general fund.
Right. Thank you.
Will that be a department bill then to reestablish it, being that it has expired?
The Department of Public Safety is supportive. I know in the last meeting of that advisory group, they had discussed about moving forward legislation on their own. We haven't decided how it's going to come forward.
But it will be coming forward apparently once you make that decision.
Yes, sir.
Some entity will.
Mr.
Ask
Chair,
for
that is correct.
Okay. So we're okay with recommending we reestablish it. Mm-hmm. Statute, I guess. Okay. All right. Forensic lab, is that you all too?
That's me as well, Mr. Chair. The Forensic Lab Advisory Committee, or commonly referred to as FLAB, is another one of the committees that expired under the sunset law in June 30th of 2009. The mission of the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board was to ensure the quality and integrity of forensic science services by laboratories that conduct forensic analysis on physical evidence in connection with criminal cases in the state of Minnesota. It was established with two basic missions. The first, to make recommendations to the legislature concerning regional labs in the state, and that mission was completed and resulted in a report to the legislature in 2008. The second recommendation was to process as an independent agency to investigate allegations of misconduct by forensic scientists. The challenge with the board was, one of the problems was that it did not have any funding to pay for an investigation. And secondary to that is that it had a specific makeup that didn't have, that lacked the expertise of specifically about how an investigation would be conducted. And moreover, the board lacked any authority to impose any type of discipline or sanctions on a body that they found to have problems. And so consequently, the board moved along, but there was other than the report that came out, the process kind of stalled. And consequently, as you recall, last year during session, the Department of Public Safety, as well as the governor, supported and recommended statewide accreditation for all laboratories that were conducting those criminal analysis. And the Department of Public Safety feels that that accreditation of laboratories would serve the same purpose that was put forth for the FLAB.
Okay, so what is that? So that if you were to do that proposal, then you wouldn't need this anymore? Is that what I should take away?
Correct. The Department of Public Safety feels that if there is accreditation of laboratories, that there would not be a need for the Forensic Lab Advisory Committee.
Mr. Speaker, I'll move to get rid of FLAB.
Okay.
But Mr.
Now, are you saying is this contingent on getting this certification in place? Or would you, even if we didn't accomplish that?
Mr. Chair, this committee has sunsetted, and so it is not in existence.
All right. Okay. Well, in any event, all right. All right, so keep this up. All right. Representative Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually, there have been some problems, I think, with this. I carried a bill a couple of sessions ago to provide some funding for this board. But I think ultimately probably the right answer is to accredit the laboratories. But something probably should be done. So for whatever it's worth.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
There have been some big problems with
Statewide radio, you are all done. Thank you very much, I guess. Statewide radio board.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jackie Mines, and I'm the director of the Emergency Communication Networks Division. And our division is responsible to support the Statewide Emergency Communications Board, formerly the Statewide Radio Board. This board was developed initially in 2005 to develop a project plan to build out a statewide shared trunked public safety radio communication system in Minnesota and develop standards and guidelines for the use of that system and focus on interoperability across the state and with our fellow surrounding states. This board is made up of an even distribution of state representation, local representation, and the metro, so Greater Minnesota and metro. And it is made up of stakeholders that would have an interest in public safety, such as law, fire, EMS, the Department of Public Safety, Department of Corrections, DNR, and MnDOT. This board has 8 standing committees, 5 which are the original committees, all which are active, and there are 3 newly created committees that deal with new public safety technologies. These boards are, these different committees are very active today. We meet on a monthly basis. The statewide radio or emergency communications board meets on a monthly basis, and the various committees meet as well. And this committee representation is duplicated on a regional level. So there are 7 regional emergency communication boards, and each of them meet. The goal here is to get input from the locals who use the system and would necessarily give us good information on how to use it best. And then at a statewide level, we share the resources, we come up with funding strategy, and we communicate that strategy back out to the various stakeholder agencies. This has been extremely successful, and on a national level, other states have met with us to try to duplicate this kind of governance structure. We would recommend that we continue to keep this.
Any discussion? I think the question that the smaller group was looking at was just the how many people and committees are involved in this. I don't know if people, in your packets there's a couple pages of membership. So that was the question, why we wanted to come in. I don't think it was to get rid of the advisory group. But can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The various committees really deal with specific items that they would have expertise regarding. So, for example, an operational and technical committee advises the statewide emergency communications board upon matters of the operations and technical use. And as such, those committee members are well-versed in the technology, as opposed to, say, the legislative and government affairs committee, which meets mostly when we have issues that are pertaining to legislative matters. And those would members are typically made up of the agencies that would likely meet up here, such as the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, Commissioners Association of Minnesota Counties, that sort of thing. And then the Finance Committee meets to discuss matters that are related to the cost of any decisions that the board makes and how those decisions will be funded. Interoperability is that's a federally mandated committee that we need to have if we want to participate in federal funds. And the list kind of goes on from there, but each of the committees has a special area of expertise, and most of the committee members on that have that expertise or can weigh in on those matters.
And they get reimbursed for travel.
They may. This is a purely volunteer committee structure, and we do have $1 million from the ECN budget that's transferred into that, and that is for to help offset travel expenses, also to fund the interoperability conference or other projects as they come up. So if it benefits the whole in terms of emergency communications, then we tend to try to fund those projects out of that $1 million.
So the $1 million is not for the actual construction or infrastructure. That's just for this committee, for these task forces and reimbursements and conferences?
It is not just for that. It has been used, for example, for grants out to the local regions for purchase of equipment that they might need or software upgrades that they might need. Each year, we kind of go through that budget and see what's got a priority use.
Can we get a couple copies of the last several years of budgets?
Absolutely.
Okay. That would be helpful. Yeah, other questions? All right. Well, I think we should probably just keep this for now. But I would like to see some of those annual operating statements or whatever you have. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Department of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's nice to be in the House today. I'm Charlene Briner from the Minnesota Department of Education, and we are here to speak to several boards, foundations, and advisory partnerships and councils. The first is the Minnesota Academic Excellence Foundation. The foundation was established in 1997 with a mission under statute to promote academic excellence in Minnesota public and non-public schools and communities through public and private partnerships. The legislature appropriated funding and operating budget to MAEF from 1997 until 2002, when funding was discontinued. And while the foundation does continue to exist and operate, its effectiveness in achieving its mission has been limited since the funds were discontinued. Sub 4 of 124D94 lists 7 programs that the foundation may administer to advance the concept of educational excellence. And at this time, MAEF is not actively engaged in any of those programs. The foundation currently has neither paid staff nor expenses. By statute, the Department of Education, MDE, is required to provide administrative support to MAEF. And currently, 4 staff members provide some level of support to the foundation, including a representative from the commissioner's office who sits on the foundation in the role of secretary. That is currently me. Because MAEF has no staff, most activities currently attributed to the foundation are carried out by MDE staff, including administration of the Ethel Curry Scholarships for American Indian Students, determination of celebration schools under the No Child Left Behind waiver and new accountability system, and the Spotlight Award. The Spotlight Award was a recognition program administered by the foundation, and in the last couple of years, it's experienced diminished participation as a result of the new accountability system by which we designate celebration and reward schools. And just for this past school year, there were only 2 schools that applied. So it's really experienced diminished.
What was the first one?
Premonition. The first one, they administer the Ethel Curry Scholarships for American Indian Students. They assist MDE with the celebration awards. And the celebration designations are made through the waiver.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And that's part of the accountability system. And then the Spotlight Awards. But none of those are the 7 that are indicated in statute.
So the 7 in statute, they just don't exist anymore.
MAEF has served in a limited capacity to assist MDE to create the celebration school application and rubric, but the bulk of that work is done by MDE staff with the assistance of MAEF members to actually review the applications. And while the goals of the foundation and the work of the board members are admirable, the effectiveness in fulfilling its mission is limited. They have struggled in recent years to find individuals with adequate experience to fill the 20 board seats required by statute, and for the last several years, several seats have remained vacant. And in fact, in just the last 4 months, 2 board members have resigned, and we're struggling to find applicants to fill those seats. Many of the public-private functions originally assigned to MAEF are carried out currently by MDE. Under the accountability system, with a waiver, we seek extensive feedback from schools and districts on the celebration applications. We are going to be holding a best practices summit for celebration schools to partner with priority and focus schools. We currently have a director of American Indian Education who works with the Tribal Nations Education Committee to jointly identify scholarship recipients. And the numerous task forces that MDE has administered that have been created both legislatively and by the commissioner or governor have had tremendous success in bringing together various stakeholders from all over the state in both public and private roles. And I think it's important to note that the MAEF board members are quite thoughtful and committed. They could be playing very important roles in other advisory capacities. And while the original mission of the foundation was admirable, there are currently likely more effective and efficient ways to accomplish the goals. And the state and MDE may be better served if the efforts put forward by MAEF were diverted to other more focused efforts.
Okay. Any discussion on that? It says there's membership fees. Are there any? Is anything collected?
Nothing is collected.
I feel like today we are hearing from the agency people, but we're not really hearing from people on these advisory committees to see if there still is. I remember MAEF, actually. There still is a desire to continue. I mean, or if there's an agreement that it should discontinue and they could put their energies elsewhere.
It's, Mr. Chair and Senator, I think that in recent months, particularly over the course of the last year and in recent months, there's been quite substantial conversation among the members. Mm-hmm. They really do feel rudderless. Mm-hmm. And the two resignations that we've recently accepted have been because the individuals did not feel as if there was necessarily a functional role for this group to play, mm-hmm. and that there were other opportunities that they were interested in pursuing.
Right.
I would also say, I'm not speaking out of turn, one of the members who chose not to reapply when his term expired actually contacted me to recommend that we might want to look at discontinuing MAEF. Mm-hmm. So there seems to be a school of thought that perhaps, well-intentioned originally, that they may have outlived their functional role.
But Senator Pappas does bring up a point that's come to me a couple of times during this. We keep asking the agencies whether they think they should have this input from groups that we've established, and this certainly isn't an implication of this one or this presentation, but oftentimes there are other views than the agencies. But I'm sure we'll get that through the legislative process. But one other thing, linking it to Representative Loeffler's comment earlier about maybe some general ways to approach best practices in grants management and awards and things like that. I mean, maybe we should hear from the Department of Admin sometime just about what we do. What is our status today in terms of best practices? Is there something that we could do more globally? Because I think that would maybe help us with this exercise that we're going through on a piecemeal basis and hearing, you know, from the agencies, which are certainly good viewpoints, but not the full extent.
Well, I think it's a fair question, and you know, and you did raise the fact. So all these are going to go through the legislative process, and so they'll get the committee hearing. We'll also come back at the end once we've gone through this with a collection of what we're proposing to repeal, particularly, and you know, we'll adopt that at the end, I think, and we'll try to give broad public notice of that as well, so that if public wants to come in and you know, object, they'll have one more chance too as well.
But it is
a very legitimate point. Any further discussion on this one?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Loeffler.
Well, we started out with Mr. Shepherd sharing kind of what things have been sort of standardized across all these different groups. And this one struck me as using the word foundation, and I'm not sure that it's the job of government to create foundations. I don't know that they're in the use of that word is the same as what normal public interpretation of that world is. So I think we also ought to look at, you know, some of these things and as they either go through or offer general guidance if we look at general things. Because even if we were to continue this, which I don't think we will, but I think that's a concern for me as well.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator.
I think Representative Loeffler brings up a good point. What is there a governing statute here? Did they actually organize this nonprofit entity called the foundation? Because it says they're supposed to be a public-private partnership, and as a foundation, they could continue to raise private money. Did they actually form a foundation?
Mr. Chair and Senator, there is an endowment by which scholarship monies are distributed for the Ethel Curry Scholarship. But beyond that, there has not been a foundation, to my knowledge.
So they didn't, Mr. Chairman, they did not go out and incorporate as a nonprofit entity?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that is correct.
They did not. Okay.
All want to recommend the repeal of this? Seeing hearing no objection, right. I'm just going to go look. I don't hear objection. All right, thank you. Next, you can choose what order you want to go.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Darren Cordy. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. I'm here to talk about the Advisory Committee for the Minnesota Braille and Talking Book Library. The Advisory Committee for the Minnesota Braille and Talking Book Library's mission is to provide strategic direction to the library staff and to provide advice to MDE on state library services for the blind and visually impaired. The group keeps the library and MDE abreast of current national and local library issues involving the blind and visually impaired. The group's comprised mostly of library users, so the group can provide quality feedback on potential impacts of service changes that the library is proposing. However, the group is small and is not always completely representative of the population served. They only have five members, which operate on four-year staggered terms. And while it's not part of the group's statutory charge, the group has been involved in some advocacy at the legislature for increased staffing at the library. The advisory board uses financial resources from the Minnesota Braille and Talking Book Library Gift Fund. Between $1,200 and $1,500 annually is budgeted for mileage and transportation and per diem for advisory board members to attend meetings. And funds, the current funds are sufficient for the group's current activities. They have begun incorporating online and telephone meetings in order to reduce expenditures. In the absence of the group, the library could use surveys and other mechanisms for gathering input and data from its users, but startup costs to do something like that would be high, and we're not convinced that any information gathered under such a survey would be more meaningful than what is collected by the advisory group. Currently, the library has a strong partnership with the State Services for the Blind. The SSB provides blind or visually impaired Minnesotans with assistance equipment, whereas the library provides library materials. There is a separate advisory council for the SSB and the state that's called the State Rehabilitation Council for the Blind. They're housed with DEED. Given the close relationship between the library and the SSB, there may want to be some exploration about combining the functions of the two. However, we wouldn't make that recommendation without the thorough input and buy-in of the disability community and their stakeholders and advocacy groups. The advocacy group is a best practice from the National Library Service, and its presence improves the Braille and Talking Book Library's rating as an agency. It's a relatively low investment of staff time and budget for a valuable service. The primary improvement that MDE could see from the advisory committee would be, or the advisory group would, to see them work in partnership with the Rehabilitation Council to form a long-term strategy rather than focusing on short-term goals separately. So again, we wouldn't suggest necessarily combining the two groups without the buy-in of stakeholders, but at this time we would recommend that this group continue.
You said five members might not be representative, but there's no, that's up to you. Not, that's not limited in the legislation as far as I can see.
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator
Pepp. And so this advisory committee was not repealed in 2009 with the sunset language?
I do not believe so.
According to the research we did, it was not.
It was not.
Yeah.
Somehow it got taken out.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how that worked, but this.
Mr. Chair, members, I think there may have been some discussion about that, but then there was some pushback from the advocacy community on,
right.
on action.
I got pulled out.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, the opportunities for people who are visually impaired are just so much bigger now than they ever used to be when these things were first started. And I'm concerned that about whether or not we're actually, when you said the five members may not be representative, I think of young people who, like, you know, we have a visually handicapped senator who know how to use technology, how to have, you know, work with documents they've never seen and put it into a computer program and you know, as opposed to some of the more elder blind who might still be using Braille because that's what they learned. I think we really need to look at whether or not, you know, we're doing enough to help people who might late in life acquire a visual disability or help are translating that into the richness that's available in technology, as opposed to being dependent upon, you know, a library that's really based on an older model. And I think that if we're to continue this, I think we should really look at whether or not they're helping us plan as a state for how to take advantage of those opportunities so more people have them. Because I just think that's a continuing challenge for us. And being able to introduce to somebody who may, because of age, lost their vision, be able to use technology will open up many more worlds than getting on a, you know, a mail service that that you run.
Right. And that gets a little beyond our
scope. But I'm just saying, if we're looking at the five and whether they're representative, if we continue this on, I think you should look at trying to get some of those young, adaptive users into the engagement.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We will definitely bring that forward and have our staff bring that to the advisory group as well.
Okay. So we should keep this one?
It's okay. One that does meet.
Okay. And we'll leave it to you all, I guess, in the education committee to think, well, it's education indeed. I don't know how we think about that consolidation. Mm-hmm. We'll have to think further about that. Okay. So who's next?
Mr. Chair, I'll continue on with the Minnesota Resource Center Advisory Committee for the Blind and Visually Impaired. The resource centers for the blind and visually impaired and the resource center for deaf and hard of hearing have been in statute since at least 1987, first as part of the Minnesota State Academies and then transferred to MDE's oversight in 1993. The purpose of the resource centers is stated in Minnesota statutes 125A.63, which states the resource centers must offer summer institutes or other training programs throughout the state for deaf or hard of hearing, blind or visually impaired, and multiply disabled pupils. The resource centers must also offer workshops for teachers and leadership development for teachers. Program offered through the resource centers must promote and develop education programs offered by school districts and other organizations. The statute also requires an advisory committee for each resource center with the legislative task to develop recommendations regarding the resource centers and submit an annual report to the Commissioner of Education. I'm first going to talk about the advisory committee for the blind and visually impaired, since the two are similar but do have some differences. The advisory group has a limited budget to support mileage and other costs for members of the advisory committee to attend meetings, which are held four times a year. Funds from this budget come from federal special education funds. The activity has a budget cap of $3,000, and at this time, there are no additional costs needed for this group. Arguably, there are other groups which could serve a similar purpose as the advisory committee, such as the Special Education Advisory Panel, which encompasses all areas of special education, or it could also be transferred back to the state academies. However, similar to the last one, we would advise close consultation with stakeholders and advocacy groups before such a change was made. A valuable component of the advisory committee for the blind and visually impaired resources is cross-agency discussion of needs and strategies for students who are blind or visually impaired. This cross-agency collaboration is a primary strength of the group. The advisory committee in no way hinders or negatively impacts the work of a special education programming for blind or visually impaired students at the agency, and there would be no additional tasks that we recommend the advisory group take on.
Any discussion? So, you want to keep these?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Non-Public Education Council.
Mr. Chair, the Non-Public Education Council is established in statute under Minnesota Statute Section 123B.445. It is a 15-member council representing various methods of providing non-public education throughout the state. The council is charged with advising the Education Commissioner on issues affecting non-public education and non-public schools. The council also has authority under statute to recognize educational accrediting agencies for non-public schools. And non-public schools or parents of children attending non-public schools can file complaints with the council about state non-public pupil aids, which the council then reviews and submits recommendations for resolution to the Commissioner of Education. The group does meet quarterly. MDES staff, which is assigned to supporting the meetings, and usually a member of the agency executive team is in attendance at each of these meetings. The council does a good job of communicating its concerns to the commissioner and effectively attempts to resolve complaints through their resolution process. The council does not receive a state appropriation for an operating budget, but the members are compensated according to the terms of Minnesota Statutes 15.0575, Subdivision 3. MDE, as I said, provides staff support to the council as well as a meeting space. The council, we find, provides an effective manner of communication between this geographically and programmatically diverse group of non-public schools and programs. It's always useful for us as a public agency to get feedback from the council on agency or legislative initiatives that are being considered, because it's not always apparent how those proposals may affect non-public schools. It would be difficult for MDE to find similarly effective conduits to those groups without the council. We are not aware of any pockets of the non-public community which aren't represented by the council, but they may exist. There's no additional tasks that we recommend the council assume, and the work of the non-public council does not overlap with any other group that I'm aware of. We recommend continuing the non-public education councils that currently exist in statute.
How many complaints do you get?
In my capacity covering, I've only handled one in the last year.
Okay. Keep it?
Yeah.
Okay. And I don't know, do we need to go through the P20 partnership, or should we just...
No, we keep it.
Time, just keep that one.
Yeah, we keep it. It's pretty new.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
All right. Department of Ag, small group, rep, suggest we keep all of these. Unless there's any objection on that. And the legislature reviewed them all, I guess, as part of the Sunset Commission or something at some point. Okay. In 2012 and 2013. So Bowser, Minnesota River Board Advisory Committee. Welcome.
Mr. Speaker, members, John Jasky, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. We had two in the list, and one had expired, and I guess that was the RIM Clean Energy Technical Committee. I guess if you want to talk about that some more, I can. Otherwise, I'll just cover the one that's still in existence, the Minnesota River Board.
Just the River Board, yeah.
Okay.
Unless anybody has questions about the other one.
Okay.
That one has already expired and is not being over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would just be curious if the agency supported the recommendation to I guess maybe the technical, what we're doing is to delete the obsolete language,
right,
if they're already repealed.
Mr. Speaker, Representative Holbart, we do support that. Speaker members, on to the Minnesota River Advisory Committee. This provision is included as a component of a statute that established the Minnesota River Board itself. The Minnesota River Board is a joint powers authority of county commissioners over the 37 counties that have a part of their county draining into the Minnesota River. The organization has been in existence since the mid-1990s. State has provided some general fund to this organization in the past. That funding did not get reappropriated this year, so they are not with state funding any longer. That is causing them to reevaluate how they want to move forward with some new efforts that are generated at the local level, and they are working on some policy language that they will likely bring to the legislature this year. That is not something that is ready to be put forth yet, because they are waiting until November to make a decision about that, and they'll bringing that to you independent of our agency, but we'll be working with them on that. So I guess my recommendation is to hold off and see where that legislation ends up, and at that point make a decision about whether an advisory board is important to their work.
Are there other rivers or watersheds that have similar advisory boards?
Mr. Speaker, there are other watershed districts and other more local organizations that certainly have advisory boards. So yes, the watershed districts and even the counties in this watershed do have their more local advisory groups. I will say that The one important thing I maybe forgot to mention is that the Minnesota River Board is supported by the Minnesota State University Mankato Water Resources Center, so they do a lot of forums and educational endeavors, and they bring a lot of people together through those forums, which certainly could happen without this advisory board in place. So, but for the fact that they're getting ready to come forward with some ideas to you, otherwise I think we would have been able to support having this one disappear. So it's timing, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Lough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is sort of a follow-up to your question, which is, you know, we have all these little watersheds, but they're all ultimately responsible for the impact on a body of water. And have you seen in the functioning of this that it actually has resulted in more sophisticated planning than if we just once again set them all free to not really interact with each other but just do their own thing? Or has that not really been the focus of their work, as far as you know?
Mr. Speaker, Representative Loeffler, specifically to this Minnesota River Board, I don't think your question is going to be able to be answered very well. But more generally, to lots of other things that deal with water, I would say very much so, that they are focused on a much more explicit way forward. We've got a lot more science and a lot more clarity about what they need to do and where they need to do it. That's a separate issue than the Minnesota River Board itself, which is, I can talk to you more about how that was constructed, but it's a different entity than the watershed districts.
Well, just to follow up, my question was not how they are different. Is that by having this, are they actually doing a higher level of planning and interconnectedness than other rivers that might have, you know, 7, 8, 20, I don't know how many watersheds along it, who don't necessarily work with maybe other than the one that neighbors them, as opposed to looking at the length of the river and its impacts?
Is this an effective model for dealing with that kind of more comprehensive look?
Thank you for the clarification. Mr. Speaker, Representative Loeffler, it very much has the potential. There's two things that this board is going to decide before they come back to you this year: how they want to be governed or how they should be governed to have that happen, and secondly, how they will find some resources to make all of those things that you describe happen. Without the resources, that can't happen. And they need to find a way to do those two things, and they're ready to do that, but they're not ready as we speak. They will be coming to you in January or February sometime with their ideas.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
And so in the past, when they've had some resources, has it been in effective ways? Or, and maybe this is a discussion for later on.
I would say their effectiveness has been proportional to their resources.
All right, that's fair. Senator Cliff.
Thank you, Mr. Jasky. Is this river board comparable to the Upper Mississippi Headwaters Board?
Mr. Speaker and Senator Scoey, similar in the following way, in that they are a joint powers of counties. The Headwaters Board, the counties basically from Morrison County north on the upper end of the Mississippi River, was initially formed to deal with zoning issues primarily. The Minnesota River Board was set up to do water quality work. So I would say that those two things are becoming closer together, though, over time, as they're focusing on a broader mission, both of the organizations.
And so it is possible that zoning would be part of their charge as they move forward.
Mr. Speaker and Senator Scoey, only to the extent that they already have that authority as counties. If they chose to combine it in some way, shape, or form through a joint powers, then yes. Or unless they came to you with a proposal to change their authorities, then at that point, you know, anything would be possible.
And just so I'm completely clear here, the Minnesota River Board is going to exist. The question is whether they're going to have the citizens advisory.
Mr. Speaker and Senator Scoey, they have to choose also to exist, because in order to exist, they have to have a joint powers agreement and they have to have some money to do something. And so that's what they're debating right now among themselves, is how best to do that. And they will need legislation to pass in order to make those two things happen in any meaningful way.
I'm just looking at the history of this. They evidently used to be the Minnesota River Basin Joint Powers Board. Mm-hmm. And somehow they became the Minnesota River Advisory Committee. So, I mean, they've got a pretty long history of working to do something in the Minnesota River.
Mr. Speaker and Senator, I'm sorry, I wasn't quite clear. The Minnesota River Board is the joint powers of counties. The advisory committee is a group that this joint powers board establishes to advise them. So it's, and the question that's here today is about the advisory committee, whether that's important or not. And what we're saying is that we believe that the county joint powers authority ought to think about that before they come to you with ideas about how to reform their jurisdiction, their authority, their mission. So the timing isn't quite right.
These counties in their joint powers, do they currently have a county funding component?
Mr. Speaker and Senator Scully, they do not have a separate funding component, and that is the principal issue that they're wrestling with.
Thank you.
Right, so we'll just hold on this one since they're coming back. So we don't recommend a repeal, I guess.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That was actually interesting in a certain way. Okay. DNR.
Welcome. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, Government Relations Director. I have with me also the Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resource Council, who will speak to the Forest Resource Council and the Forest Resource Research Investment Committee. The Advisory Committee, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. So with that, I believe the two committees you would like to area, the Cuyuna Country State Recreation Area Citizens Advisory Council and the Off-Highway Vehicle Safety Advisory Council,
right,
that I will speak to. The Cuyuna Country SRA group, the purpose is to advise the DNR in preserving and utilizing the Cuyuna Country State Recreation Area by assisting us with major decisions related to this development, planning, and management. It was established by the local units of the local citizenry up there, actually, in 2007. You'll see on the list that we provided you a list of the membership. I won't go into that in great detail. There is no compensation provided to the members. Prohibits per diem in the statute. They have met three times over the past year. They do play a vital role in the management of that unit, which is really a up-and-coming. It's one of the premier mountain biking destinations within the state and also in the Midwest, and becoming one within the country as well. So it does play a good role for us. There's a lot of positive engagement with them, and they help kind of promote and enhance the area with marketing and also outside funding opportunities that may exist as well.
So what about other state recreation areas, or is that it?
We have seven state recreation areas in the state, Mr. Chairman, members. We work with local citizenries. This one was actually established in statute by former Representative Chris Haskamp as an important component of the unit. So recognizing the desire of the locals in the area, we keep it and keep it running and functioning. View it as a valuable component. Most of our units in state parks have friends groups. If you have a state park in your area, you're probably familiar with the local friends groups, which are organized as a nonprofit group. They meet, they provide us direction. We meet with them annually. They interact with local legislators. Representative David, Senator Scoy, I'm sure you've had the occasion of meeting with friends groups for the parks in your areas and probably many others as well. This one's just a little unique in that it's established in statute. So.
My next kind of the question, I think, why this one and not any others. And so, well, no, so this was in 07. So John Ward would have been not Haskamp, right?
Well, it was there for a while. Actually, she was on the committee at the time. So we were trying to change it a little bit several times, and because of the support from the local area, we did not change it. So I recommend you consider any changes. Talk to Representative Ward for it.
Okay.
Chairman, Capital Investment Committee was just up there. Now, they didn't there were a number of citizens. In fact, there's another member of this group that was up there, I think, as well. You were up there, Representative Davis. There were a number of volunteers around. It seemed to be a particularly active area relative to describing what their needs were for their capital investment request.
So there is a lot of activity up there, I guess is my point, whether they were advisory board members or just other citizens that were kind of engaged, I'm not sure, but it may be one that we would want to think about before we would repeal, simply because there's a lot of activity. More so than I think in other areas. I've been out with LCCMR years ago and so on, and you know there are all those friends groups, but this one seemed to be at a little different activity level than some of the others in terms of engagement.
Mr. Chairman, members, the area, Deerwood, the local communities realize that with the loss of mining industry that their future is basically in the tourism and outdoor recreation industry, and this group is really proactive in helping that happen with the state, with the DNR, with the legislature, and also with the local community. So we believe they provide value. Whether it should be in statute or not is a question I think you all need to take amongst yourselves. But I think if you would repeal it, we would still work with them as if they were still around. We would probably try to find another means to keep them going. It's a very low maintenance, high profile opportunity for us.
Well, Mr. Chair, and kind of going to the, you have a number of recreation areas across the state. This is the only group that has a organization created here at the state level. Is there anything that they do that they couldn't do if they were put out on your own? In other words, if they were treated like all the other recreation area and state park areas in the state? I mean, do they have any special powers or abilities that they would lose if we would take them out of state statute and allow them to function like the other areas do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, that's a great question. And if you look at the language in 85.0146 that really establishes this group under subdivision 2D, it states, before a major decision is implemented in the Cuyuna Country State Rec Area, the area manager must consult with the council and take into consideration any council comments or advice that may impact the major decision. That would be the one thing you would lose, though we would still consult with the groups about major decisions. And oftentimes we need to take the advice that they give us, but this gives them, I think, some level of comfort that any changes to the unit is going to be consistent to what their vision is. But we would do that anyway. So the answer to your question is, I don't think anything would change. They may view it as that, though.
Well, Mr. Chair, the point I was going to make is I'm assuming that the commissioners and the park directors take into account local input, whether or not you have a named group or not.
Mr. Chairman, most definitely. That cooperation is essential for those units to exist.
So what are the other six recreation areas? And I don't like it, but so
we have the off-road park state recreation area. There's I can provide you a list of all of them.
So, I mean, I guess the question is, I mean, this also identifies particular people to be on this advisory committee in statute, right, as opposed to just putting together and ahead, you know, in these other places, I suppose anybody could put in, including an elected state official. Okay, so there we go. So I'm just wondering if this is something we should think about more broadly for the other recreation areas, too. I mean, that would be the other direction to go and just make this more generalized, right?
Mr. Chair, that's why we're at opposite ends of the spectrum.
Oh, no,
you're talking about adding six. I'm saying, why do we need one?
No, I agree. That's, I mean, you asked the right question. Is what is this different from others? And it's not clear that there is anything. The only other thing that's different from others is it says in statute who these people are, as opposed to, and I don't know if there's any advantage or disadvantage to that, but it seems unfair in some sense.
Mr. Chairman, for the reasons I said earlier, I lean toward keeping, but another approach being that we just did it with another activity would be to put it on hold until we maybe heard a little bit more. But I would suggest one of those two particular options.
This may be what we're going to hear from the people, too, as Senator Lori was talking about.
That's what I was meaning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we should really look at, I mean, I think the Friends model has worked well in other areas, and maybe we should have one uniform approach, and it doesn't really matter if it's designated a state park or a recreational area, but just have a standardized approach, and in the we could put in legislation authorizing, you know, they should be broadly representative of the users and the local impacts and blah, blah, blah. But I tend to think rather than having each one customize it and deciding who they want and who they don't want on their local group, that the more we can kind of just have some generic recognition that they're an advisor group to DNR. And I think that would be actually a better way to go. When school districts consolidate, then all of a sudden you've got, oh, somebody from this school district, and you got to change the statute just because the name changed. And, I mean, it just seems like it's the law books of the state don't need to have all that detail.
All right. So can I just suggest this, is that I do a little bit of checking here, and I come back to the group at the next meeting?
So it would be in the hold category?
The hold category, just for now.
Mr. Chairman, we can coordinate with your staff to get you whatever you need.
Yeah, appreciate that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, as a representative that has two recreation areas in my district, the Big Pond Recreation Area and Lake LaSalle, I'm not advocating for each of those to have this authority.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, would it be all right if we skip to the OHV Safety Advisory Council? Because it's related to this conversation we just had about voluntary versus mandatory.
That would be great.
This group was established in 84.9011 Subdivision 4, providing the commissioner to appoint an off-highway vehicle safety advisory council, talking about their roles is to provide us with consulting on off-highway vehicle safety and then standards and certification for organizations and individuals participating as volunteers. This language did get caught up in kind of the cleanup language, I believe it was in 09, so it was abolished. But we continued meeting, and we were asked by the groups, in particular All-Terrain Vehicle Association and the Amateur Rider Motorcycle Association, earlier this fall to continue the group on. We looked at the commissioner's duties and authorities and powers in Chapter 84, and it was our opinion that we do have the authority to continue meeting, and we're going to do that voluntarily. So just as you talked about, do we have the ability to do this? Yes, we do. But we could also come back and reestablish the Off-Highway Vehicle Safety Commission Council statutorily as well. We just thought since we have the ability to do so, we will continue meeting. The group will continue meeting as it has been, provide input on our safety training programs.
We can just let it stay expired, or?
Well, are they asking for
it? I can't tell if you're asking that we.
No, the groups are perfectly fine with the commissioner under his authority to continue the establishment of the group. So we do not feel, nor are we asking at this point in time, for legislative authority for that group to exist. But they will still provide us the information we need.
So I guess what we have to ask of you is, would the commissioner support deleting the obsolete language regarding the Off-Highway Vehicle Safety Advisory Council that was repealed in 2009?
Madam Chair, I believe we would, but I would like to consult with the groups to make sure they're comfortable with that. Or Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberger, I'd like to just consult with the groups to make sure they're comfortable with it as well. Or maybe we could redraft that section and provide some comfort language for people there.
Yeah, and just talk to Kate.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Myers, does this council give advice on the safety training that is provided?
That was the intent. The intention was for the safety training programs and also for the trail ambassador program when it was established. We do have a separate trail ambassador group as well that we work with.
Well, and if they're giving advice for the safety training programs, maybe they should have a little be in the statutes. I mean, they're actually providing a pretty valuable service there, I would think. Just for further discussion, maybe the department wants to contemplate that. I don't know.
We will take that under advisement, Mr. Chairman, and provide a recommendation to you all.
So we need to take action one way or the other, to delete the obsolete language or to clarify that this is, and I don't know how we're going to do that. I guess we can just write something that says 2009 thing doesn't apply to this, 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 and this, something like that. if we want to bring things back. Okay. Thank you. So on the, I'm looking at the clock. My guess is that we're not going to want to repeal the Forest Resources Council or the Advisory Committee unless I hear any objection to that. And so I know, thank you for coming in, but if it's okay with you, could we move on and not address this
one? That would be our recommendation, Mr. Chair. Safety okay.
Mr. Speaker, you're in charge of the meeting.
Really, the reason I had wanted you folks to come in is to highlight the work you're doing, which I think shows that these councils and task forces often do very good work. But in the interest of time, I'd like to move on.
Thank you.
Okay. Where are we? PCA, hi. How are you?
Mr. Chair and commission members, for the record, my name is Kirk Adelka. I'm assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'll go briefly to the two that are noted in the agenda. The first is a Small Business Air Quality Compliance Advisory Council.
Mr. Meyer, can I just interrupt? You're okay with the other ones we're recommending be repealed? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
The Small Business Air Quality Compliance Advisory Council is a required part of our air permitting. Each state is required to have this under the Federal Clean Air Act. It is, along with a number of our other small business programs, such as the Small Business Ombudsman and Small Business Assistance Program, is part of our state implementation plan, also known as the SIP, which is federally approved by EPA. The SIP actually specifically cites the language in statute 116.99 as part of its documents. At this time, we haven't used the Small Business Compliance Advisory Council. We've used our other tools, that are including our ombudsman, our assistance programs, and working directly with individual industry groups. For example, on the non-metallic general air permit, which is focusing on sand and gravel operations, we've worked with the industry group as a sounding board on creation of that permit and any concerns we have with the compliance and the carrying out of that permit. We found that to be a better tool. While we have not formally called this group to order over the last decade, this is not unfamiliar compared to the rest of the states. About half of the states in the nation, whilst having an advisory council like this, also do not have an active one. At this time, if the agency decided to repeal or the legislature decided to repeal the council, we would have to modify our SIP, go through a public process, and submit it to the feds, who would then most likely deny it of the change. At this point, we would believe that it would be good to keep the statutory language in law.
Okay. So it's because it's part of the agreement that you've reached with the federal government about this. Yes, Senator Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I represent an area that's a lot of industry, a lot of Superfund sites, and a lot of air quality concerns. And while last summer I was spending a lot of time in meetings with PCA staff with my neighbors about a particular business and its permit, what we discovered through the modeling was that it was likely there were exceedances or at least elevated levels of fine particulates and other things that the professional staff attributed probably to also being an overlapping concern from other small businesses in the area, other industries, who were not large enough to come under the regulation and oversight of PCA normally. And so I think keeping this on the books, if PCA follows through on its interest in trying to look at overlapping pollution impacts of smaller industries that are clustered together, this might ultimately be something you'd want to activate in those circumstances, which is different than dealing with it in a specific industry like the fracking sand, because it's multiple different chemical and manufacturing industries that are all just clustered together, but that all contribute enough to be a concern, even though individually they may not. And so just keeping this on the books as a potential to be activated, I think, is a good thing.
Any other discussion on that? All right, so we'll keep it. It's not clear that, whether we have to take any action because this... It's not clear if this is required by federal law or not, although arguably it is. So there's an exception to this 2009 deal that if it's required by federal law, it didn't expire. And so I think that's what this language in the box there means. So we'll look a little bit more closely at that. All right. On the subsurface sewage.
Mr. Chair and Commission members, the next item is the SSTS Implementation and Enforcement Task Force. SSTS is our septic system regulations, and it really is a partnership, the regulations and program between counties and the MPCA. And this task force is an important forum for both of us to tackle the difficult issues of implementing the program. Some of the recent successes over the last few years is after the 2008 septic system rule changes, there were a number of differences between the counties and the agency. And through this group, we were able to come to a conclusion, including legislation in 2012 that we jointly carried before the legislature to bring that item to a close. We've created a grant program to help all counties with costs of approving advanced design systems to help relieve the burden on county budgets, and also worked on enforcement protocols and forms to create a uniform way to move forward local enforcement cases and provide state assistance where needed. Before the task force, other methods were attempted, including the advisory committee that was mentioned in Subdivision 12 of the same statute. However, it was unsuccessful. Our other attempts with individual contacts with counties and others also proved to be less than fruitful. The face-to-face meetings outside of the construction season, which has been the best format for this task force, has been very helpful. Travel and meal costs are covered by the actual members, not the MPCA or state. The state does kick in coffee sometimes and cookies, so there is a small budget, but that is about it. At this time, both the agency and the Association of Minnesota Counties support the continuation of the task force under Minnesota Statute 115.55, Subdivision 13, and the elimination of the advisory committee in Subdivision 12, which is also noted on your handout.
Okay. And what about the Nuclear Waste Council?
Mr. Chair and Commission members, that is under the purview of the EQB. While the PCA is not the EQB, we do work jointly together on many situations, including filling out the required questionnaire here, and we both agree that it is a good idea to repeal it at this time.
Okay. So keep the SSTS Implementation Task Force and repeal the System Advisory Committee and the Nuclear Waste Council. Okay. No objection. One more to go. Thank you, DOT.
Mr. Speaker, members, good afternoon. My name is Tim Hinkle. I'm an assistant commissioner with MnDOT and current chair of the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access. With me is Joan Wilshire. She's the executive director of the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities and is the current vice chair of the Council on Transportation Access. In the interest of your time, I'm not going to pull up the PowerPoint presentation that we've made available to you in handout form. I will instead make quick reference to a couple of the highlights, as our recommendation is to continue this council, as the duties of this council contained in statute have not been completed, as well as the importance of this council and its continued work. Some of those highlights within this PowerPoint will provide some information that informs your decision against that recommendation. First and foremost, a little bit of history. This council was formed by Minnesota statutes out of 2010, statute 174.285. It did succeed an interagency committee on transit coordination that existed under executive order from the Pawlenty administration, which was put in place back in 2005. While coordination activities were occurring and similar members were meeting under the auspices of that executive order, only with the appropriations now and under the statute have we been able to make good progress in some of the issues that have been identified and the duties that have been put in place. That appropriation is important to the work of this committee as it moves forward. The purpose of this committee, as stated in law, is this: the Council on Transportation Access is established to study, evaluate, oversee, and make recommendations to improve the coordination, availability, accessibility, efficiency, cost-effectiveness, and safety of transportation services provided to the transit public. Transit public means those persons who utilize public transit and those who, because of mental or physical disability, income status, or age, are unable to transport themselves and are dependent upon others for transportation services. States across the U.S. are facing the same complexities and issues. One of the questions that you wanted answered is whether there is a more efficient means to provide this coordination. If we look at examples of state coordinating councils in other states across the U.S., or regional coordinating councils across the U.S., you will find that this is the means that's being employed in the majority of states in the United States. I believe there's only 5 or 6 states that do not have some form of coordinating council recognized in law or otherwise, or some regional coordinating mechanism that allows them to address some of the complexities that the duties of this statute require us to look at. The membership is unique to those advisory councils that committees that you've been looking at today, in that we have 13 members that cut across the key agencies that can provide for those transportation services. Those are listed in one of the slides that you have if you want to look at that in more detail.
And I think that was, now that I'm thinking about it, I think that was why we were questioning this one, is because it seems like it's all agency people. And there's no public particularly. And so why do we need a statute that allows agency people to come together? I guess I think that was what prompted us to get here. So if you want to answer that, why can't you just do it under executive order like Governor Plenty did?
Mr. Chairman and members, it is important that those coordinating agencies, those that provide those transportation services, come together, because they are the independent agencies that receive different appropriations under federal or state law and are responsible providing services via those federal laws or state laws. Coordination across those agencies is what will allow us to find areas for cooperation, coordination, and administration of those programs that might be more effective than those occurring in silos as they have occurred historically. So it is critical that this particular body continue and that those members of those state agencies come together to allow for that potential to happen.
So I guess, how is it working better now than it was from 2005 to 2010?
Mr. Chairman and members, it is working better first and foremost in that we are working with the appropriation to study where we have opportunities or gaps.
You didn't have any money before.
We did not have money before.
All right.
So those resources allow us to do that and to identify what those are.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just got a text message from your senator asking us to save this agency, not repeal
it.
I'm
sure he does.
Just coincidentally, he just texted me. Senator Dibble.
He probably carried the bill.
Yeah, he probably did.
Okay.
He must be watching.
One person watching.
Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think there's probably a good function for this, but I do share your concerns about there's no public input into this, and that some of the things that are in their purview might lead to issues that for the actual users of the system that don't have a vehicle to come into this planning. For example, now that we have some buses that have, I forget what the name is, but it's low entrance so that a person with a walker or some disability could get onto the bus, that's really wonderful for the people who have the ability to get to the bus stop. But in the winter, when we have our mountains of snow, expecting someone to go 4 or 5 blocks across those mountains at every corner to get to that bus stop may not be a fair expectation, when other people with the exact same disability in the same area might qualify for Metro Transit and get door-to-door service. And so I hear from my constituents that there's maybe some inequities and are perceived inequities in the system. And if we're going to keep this, I would really like to see in their charge some responsibility to provide for some public input into these plans, because they're going to impact a lot of lives.
Mr. Speaker, Representative, as we go through some of the examples, I would argue that there is opportunity for public input. We can always improve on the public input, but for example, every meeting allows for the opportunity for public input. It is a specific agenda item. We have had opportunities for that public input in the meeting setting. Also, the work plan does include webinars and other opportunities where we're providing information as well as garnering input from those that are interested in the topics that are being discussed, as well as the studies that are moving forward in our work plan for 2015 that are looking at opportunities for coordination, vehicle sharing, where we're going to need to get additional public input as those studies move forward. My question would be, does that need to be strengthened in any way? And we would welcome any input that this body has as to how we might do that, given that work plan that exists and what our intentions are currently.
Senator Pappas and then Representative Holt.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Dibble was channeling us. He says that I think their ideas are perfect for an unsession and they're all about finding efficiencies. So just what you were saying.
Thank you. Representative
Hobart. Well, and Mr. Chair, I have been guilty of this in this process, but I mean, I think I have to keep going back to that. We're supposed to be more at the 10,000 foot level here, and whether or not these things need to be reformed are probably policy committee discussions, and that our job here, at least in my mind, if I'm sticking to the task, is those that are easily not functioning or serving a purpose, making a recommendation to get rid of them. Those that are working great and wonderful, leave them alone. But those that need maybe some amending or a little bit of change, that would be more a committee process, not for us as the LCPFP to do.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's right. You know, my only concern here is that this is several agency heads who have their own budgets, and then there's $100,000 more going to pay the agency heads to get together and meet and do studies and that kind of stuff. And so the Transportation Committee might, you know, partly it's just a question of there is probably no place for this kind of group coming together to, there's no incentive. There's multiple agencies here. The money's coming from one committee, right? And I don't know. I'm not articulating myself very well, obviously. Senator Skoy, lean forward. No, not going to bail me out?
Not going to bail me out.
Okay. So that would be my only thought on this, but it probably is more of a whether the Transportation Finance Committee wants to use $100,000 of their budget on this project, I guess is for them in some sense. Or for all of us, but they're to go through their committee.
I mean, I just think that we could spend all kinds of time deciding what would be the most wonderful structure, access, and involvement, recommend putting members of the public on it, et cetera. The reality is that bill would still go to the Transportation Policy Finance Committee, and they would do what they want, irregardless of our recommendation.
All right. Well, why don't we just keep it then for now? Is that okay? All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just continue with two other items to highlight this council and to answer, I think, one additional question that you had. The work plan is included in your handouts, so you can see what has been accomplished in terms of the work historically, as well as the work that's envisioned for the next fiscal year. The question that you asked specifically was regarding the appropriation and its use for travel reimbursement. And I wanted to make clear, if you look at this slide, it's the Makota annual budget, the $100,000 appropriation. About 85% goes to the actual work website and annual report. That's almost 95%. The travel reimbursement of $4,000 is available only to those non-state employees who are members of the council, the Board on Aging, as well as the APTA representative, the transit representative. The rest of the state employees do not receive any reimbursement whatsoever.
Okay, thank you.
So that concludes my remarks. I think those points highlight and answer the specific questions that you had regarding this board. Our recommendation continues to be that of continuing this council so that it can complete its duties.
All right, thank you. How about the other pieces? MnDOT.
So what did he say about these two then?
Mr. Chair, I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. If I could just briefly address the Commuter Rail Corridor Advisory Committee that was marked for likely repeal. The department concurs that committee can be repealed. There's currently no commuter rail corridor under development, so there is no need to have the the committee continue in existence.
Okay, thank you.
And then lastly, the...
Any discussion on that?
I'm sorry.
All right, thanks.
The county and municipal state aid advisory committees.
Mm-hmm.
The mission of these committees is to guide the commissioner on the content of state rules that govern the state aid system related to designation of state aid roads, how funds are expended on those roads, and the design standards that are used. The committee is made up of county engineers, city engineers, county commissioners, city council members from around the state. There's no specific budget for the committees, but the meetings cost around $3,000 for reimbursement for mileage and lodging and meals. The committees currently exist in two places in statute. However, they have always met as one committee. And so I think the main question from this group to us was, can they be combined in statute into one location? And we support that. And, in fact, we've already started looking at some draft language that we could provide. And we'd also be willing, I think, to carry that in a department bill to combine the two committees into one place in statute, so it's more clear that they do function as one committee.
Okay.
So is that the County State Aid Highway Advisory Committee and the Municipal State Aid Street?
Well, correct.
Yep. Yes. So we keep them, but with the idea that we could combine them statutorily.
And I guess what we're looking for is that we have the language in statute reflect the practice. Because you really don't have two separate groups operating.
Exactly.
Okay.
So everybody's okay with that? All right. Thank you. I guess that does it. Thank you for your patience, everybody. And I'll talk to Mary Liz and the others. We have a couple more agencies to get through, which we may take up in November, like DHS and health. So I think that's about all that's left. All right. Thanks, everybody. We are, unless there's any other business, Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, I'll just, on behalf of the rest of the members, thank the task force for weeding through. This made it a lot easier. Thank you.
All right. We're adjourned.
St. Paul, Cayuna 1.